From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Unemployment is near a 50-year low, and we're at what economists call full employment, meaning everyone who wants a job can have one. And the jobless rate is also at historic lows for both Hispanics and African Americans, something President Donald Trump touted again on his biggest stage of the year, the 2019 State of the Union back in February.
African American, Hispanic American, and Asian American unemployment have all reached their lowest levels ever recorded.
But not everyone's a winner in this economy, and not everyone's celebrating. There are fault lines here, cracks and fissures, things like slow wage growth or unequal wages in equal jobs. Courtney Herring worked at the Kohler Distribution Center in eastern Wisconsin for years before learning many of her colleagues doing exactly the same work made twice as much as she did.
It really did open my eyes to see what was really happening and how much of an opportunity I was actually missing compared to what I thought I was getting. It made me realize, oh man, this is a huge gap.
Well, all this week, NPR has a special series of reports taking an in-depth look at what full employment means in the lives of real people. And this hour on Point, who wins and who loses in a strong labor market? And you can join us. What does the job market look like for you where you are? Are you finding the work you want? Or are the wages not keeping up with what you need? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us today from Washington is Scott Horsley, NPR's chief economics correspondent. He's one of the lead reporters on this new series from NPR about full employment. And you can find a link to his piece headlined, America is in Full Employment, So Why Aren't We Celebrating? That link is at onpointradio.org. Scott, welcome to On Point.
Great to be with you.
It's really great to have you. So first of all, set the stage here for us a little bit. I mean, when we say full employment, what are we talking about exactly? How good is the job market right now?
The job market, if you look at the country as a whole, is very good. As you mentioned, the unemployment rate, the macro unemployment rate's near a 50-year low, the lowest it's been in generations. There are obviously regional variations. There are educational variations. Not everybody's sharing in that. But we wanted to kind of look behind those numbers and say, what does it mean when we have a job market that's that strong? What does it mean for employers who are struggling to find good workers? What does it mean for workers who maybe have found some restoration of the bargaining power that they'd lost over the years, an ability to command higher wages or better working conditions? And so my colleagues on the business desk and I sort of fanned out around the country to try to tell some of those stories all this week.
And they're absolutely fascinating. And we're going to focus in this hour on sort of two aspects of this reporting that you and your colleagues have done. We'll talk about two-tier wage systems and the employment situation for Hispanics and African Americans. But Scott, I just wanted to get a little more sense from you about a third part here, just because I can, because it's so fascinating about how the unemployment rate is so low in certain places that employers simply cannot find the workers they need. I mean, you went to Ames, Iowa, where employers are just hungering for folks to fill jobs. What's going on in Ames?
Well, and actually, it was my colleague Jim Zeroli who went to Ames.
Oh, Jim did. Okay.
I've spent a good deal of time there myself, though, so I can certainly attest to the strong job market throughout Iowa, even with some of the troubles that they've been having in their agricultural sector with low crop prices and, of course, this spring with some real severe flooding as well. But in general, the Iowa economy is very strong, and the job market is very strong in places like Ames, which is a very nice college town about an hour north of maybe less than an hour north of the capital of Des Moines. One thing that is happening is folks are just not moving to Iowa in large numbers. In fact, the state population has really been kind of stagnant. And even though there's this very strong job magnet, people around the country are not saying, hey, let's pick up and move to Ames, Iowa. And so the sort of market forces that you would expect to level out those variations in unemployment rates aren't necessarily coming to work. The same thing is true in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, where I went and talked with Courtney Herring at the Kohler factory there. The unemployment rate in Sheboygan is around 2.5%, higher than Ames, but still well below the national average. And yet folks are not, you know, just itching to move to the edge of the Great Lakes there in Wisconsin. I don't know why. It's a very nice place to live. Maybe it's the cold winters. They've tried to market the city as, you know, Malibu of the Midwest. Even though it's gotten positive rankings as a great place for millennials to come and set up a home and start a family, they're not necessarily attracting population. And so when they do have a successful company, a successful business, they struggle to find workers.
So first of all, let me apologize to our colleague Jim Zarulli there for asking you about one of his stories there. So sorry about that, Jim. My deep apologies. But Scott, tell us more about in Sheboygan. What specifically is going on there that's created such a great job market? And we'll talk about why people aren't moving there in a second. But why is the economy so healthy there in terms of jobs?
Well, Wisconsin as a whole has long been a pretty manufacturing intensive state. They've had more manufacturing than many states around the country, and the Kohler Company is an example of that. This is a company that's been in business for almost a century and a half there along the Sheboygan River. It started as a iron foundry making farm equipment and then morphed into bathtubs and kitchen fixtures, the kind of thing that the Kohler name is probably best known for today. But they also make other products. They make engines for lawnmowers and snowblowers and that sort of thing. So they have a pretty big industrial base. There's a lot of other industry in the area. There's the Johnsonville sausage companies in Sheboygan. Sargento Cheese has a factory there. So Kohler was competing for factory labor with a number of other companies in the area. And if you go back to the recession back in 2010, Kohler had adopted this two-tier wage structure, which was not uncommon at the time when the economy was in free fall, where they were saying, well, we're going to keep paying our existing workers what they've been making, what they're accustomed to making. But for anybody we hire on now, they're going to come in at a much lower wage, lower benefits, all kinds of challenges. And, you know, even though it was a unionized workforce, the economy at that time in 2010 was so weak that the union sort of had to grudgingly swallow this. And now they've been trying for nearly a decade to kind of whittle away at that. And they finally succeeded in late 2018 at getting a new contract that effectively does away with that two-tiered wage scale.
Yeah.
The same thing happened with the big three automakers. They had agreed to a two-tiered wage scale back in the recession. They've been chipping away at it as the economy has improved, and they're coming into new negotiations this fall, the big three automakers with the UAW, and the UAW hopes to accelerate the phase-out.
Well, that's exactly why I think this NPR series is so important, right? Because when we broadly talk about low unemployment numbers, we're speaking about averages, right? And the averages always conceal what you're talking about, these strong regional variations and the stories within the stories of those numbers.
Yeah, and in the case of these two-tier wage scale, not only regional variations, but on the same factory floor,
exactly.
You have people doing the same job and younger workers, typically younger workers, newer workers making considerably less than their more senior colleagues. And unionized labor is a shrinking set of the overall workforce, but this is just kind of indicative of worker bargaining power in general.
Mm-hmm.
And when unemployment is at 10%, workers don't have a lot of bargaining power. You would think with unemployment at 3.6% nationally, 2.5% in Sheboygan, 1.5% in Ames, workers would have the power to say, if you want me to do this job, you're going to have to pay me a little bit more. And to some extent, we're seeing that.
Well, I actually just want to listen to a clip here of tape. This is George Cooper, who drives a truck for Kohler, and he got his job there a couple of years ago after the Great Recession had more or less faded from its peak. And he found that the two-tiered contract locked in lower wages, as you were saying, Scott, compared to other drivers doing the same work. And Courtney Herring, who we mentioned before, who works in the distribution center and has been at Kohler for 7 years, also saw that friction as well, as people were being asked to do the same level of work for less. So we'll hear both of them in this clip.
Didn't matter how long I was there, I was never going to reach that same peak plateau that they did.
Then you end up having your cliques because, oh, they're tier A and we're tier B and we shouldn't do the same type of work. They would just tell you flat out, well, why should I do the same amount of work as that tier A that's been there 20 years?
Well, so Scott Horsley, stand by here for just a second because I want to turn now to Alexia Kulwick. She's joining us from Madison, Wisconsin. She's a professor in the School for Workers at the University of Wisconsin, former lead attorney for the Service Employees International Union, Local 1 in Chicago. Alexia Kulwick, welcome to you.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me today.
It's great to have you. So first of all, you heard Scott Horsley there and his reporting talking about how, yes, we have this very like rock bottom unemployment level right now, unemployment rate. But even with on the same factory floor, for example, because of these two-tiered wage systems, in some places we're seeing a big disparity in wages. I mean, how long has that been going on?
Well, we've seen two-tier wage systems in place, really, as we've seen union power decline. So we first saw a big wave of two-tiered wage systems come into place in the 1980s. And I think that Scott's reference to the recession 2008-2010, we started seeing even more of these two-tier wage systems. So what we've seen is even if when we're down at low employment, that doesn't necessarily mean that wages have kept up or that health benefits and pension benefits have kept up to benefit the workers.
And as Scott was saying, though, as we have, this very hot labor market, does that translate into potentially more power for labor, for union, if their workers are in such high demand?
I think it certainly has potential for unions and their workers to obtain better benefits in this time of lower unemployment. Colder was a really great example. I think that, though, you can't change things overnight. So we're back in a better economy today. And as Scott said, these wages have been put into place in a collective bargaining agreement. So by contract, now they're already settled. And once you've given something away at the bargaining table in collective bargaining, it's very, very difficult to get that back. And so having given it up in the recession, workers are trying to improve things, but it's very difficult.
Well, we are talking about what this full employment economy actually looks like in the lives of real people. NPR is running a special series about it all of this week. Scott Horsley, NPR's chief economics correspondent, is with us. And Alexia Kulwick, professor in the School for Workers at the University of Wisconsin, is also with us as well. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about what a full employment economy looks like in the lives of real people. And that when we talk about the historic low unemployment rate, what sort of variations and regional differences are being masked by that one low average number? NPR is running a special series about full employment all this week. And Scott Horsley joins us. He's NPR's chief economics correspondent. Alexia Kulwick is also with us. She's a professor in the School for Workers at the University of Wisconsin. And we want to hear from you. What is the employment situation looking like where you live? Are you an employer who's having trouble finding workers? Or are you someone who has exited the job market and is now trying to get back in, but the wages are too low to meet your needs? Scott Horsley, let me turn back to you here for a second and just ask you, tell us more about what the situation in Sheboygan, what it illuminates for us in terms of how we better understand this this full employment economy.
Well, it's kind of a microcosm of the improved bargaining power, and in this case, collective bargaining power that workers have as a result of the strong job market and low unemployment. But it's not, you know, a consistent picture across the country. Even in this environment, we saw, for example, UPS just adopt a contract with the Teamsters that actually puts in a new two-tiered wage scale. We saw there was a General Electric locomotive factory in Erie, Pennsylvania that GE sold, and the new owners there tried to impose a two-tier wage scale just in this past winter. That prompted one of the first big industrial strikes of the Trump era, and right now that's kind of in limbo. The two sides are in mediated talk, so we'll see if the company is successful there in imposing a two-tiered wage scale or if the union is successful in holding the line and saying, no, in this climate, we're not gonna go that route.
Interesting. Alexia Kulik, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah, I think while we see increased bargaining power, I also think that kind of like I said before the break, it doesn't necessarily turn quickly. And so while I think that the example in Sheboygan was fantastic, I also think it was a little bit of a special case in that we are seeing a lot of workers around the country not being able to influence and use that power to increase their wages and benefits again. And that's true throughout Wisconsin as well as, I think, other parts of the country. And part of that has to do with the decrease in union density and the loss of bargaining power that we've seen. What I will say about the examples that were given, the Teamster two-tiered wages that have just been put into place, it has been very controversial. And it will be interesting to see how things go going forward, because I think a lot of those members realized that we are in a better position and that shouldn't have been agreed to.
Okay, so
The Teamsters membership actually voted against it, but because of some wrinkles in the way the votes are tallied, and they needed a two-thirds, they needed a supermajority to reject the contract, and so it has gone into force. Mm.
Alexia, right. When you say union density, though, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, so in Wisconsin, the private sector density is down to about 6.7% throughout the state. Throughout the country, of course, we're below 10%. We're probably about 7-something in terms of how many people within the workplace are members of a union and therefore able to engage in collective bargaining over the terms and conditions of their employment.
I see. Well, actually, I just want to hear a little bit more from Courtney Herring. Scott, you talked to her. She worked in the Kohler Distribution Center for the past 7 years. We heard her a little earlier in the show about the difficulties around that two-tiered wage system. But she says the mood has improved on the factory floor since a new contract was signed, and now she can envision being at Kohler for the long run.
You could tell there was a lot of happy people, a lot of them. Production went up. People are wanting to stay for more overtime because they know it's worth their time now. I was told, don't go in a factory, don't go in a factory. You're not going to have a life there. It feels like I do, and I'm getting somewhere, so I could see myself being here for my career. My family's been in it for at least 40-plus years, so I like to kind of continue that tradition.
That's Courtney Herring, who's worked in the Kohler Distribution Center for the past 7 years. Alexia Kulik, let me just ask you about, once again, there's a big difference between what the numbers ostensibly say versus what people are experiencing in their real lives. And in Courtney there, we heard a sense of relief and security that she hadn't felt before this new contract was signed. But, you know, given what you had been talking about regarding unions' overall reduction in power and influence over the past 40 years, I mean, what's it going to take to get that same sense of security for other workers?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, again, the Kohler strike in Sheboygan is a great example of what it takes. And what it takes is more engagement from more workers to participate in acting collectively to try to improve those wages and benefits. And what we saw in Sheboygan that we haven't touched on is that the workers went on strike to chip away at that two-tier wage system, and they had community behind them. So, you know, people in the community were supportive of the workers' plight, and the workers were very strong in going out on strike and exerting power to be able to influence the collective bargaining agreement. And that, in turn, had an influence in what Kohler agreed to. And I think because of the overall loss of union density, and I'll just say here in Wisconsin, we've seen a legislative attack on workers in the public sector in 2011 and right to work in 2015. Workers are pretty demoralized, and it's difficult to exert that collective power that they really do have when they come together like the workers at Kohler did.
Right. Scott, just jump in here, because I'm wondering if you heard that from workers in your reporting. And I imagine that even as good as the job market is now, are people still wondering what's going to happen when the next downturn comes? Because that's an inevitability eventually.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, we're almost 10 years into this economic expansion now. But if you ask most Americans, do you feel like you've been gaining ground for 10 years? They'll say no. They might feel like they've been gaining ground maybe for the last year, maybe the last couple of years, or maybe they don't even feel like they're gaining ground yet. The scars of the Great Recession are deep and long-lasting. You know, when Kohler initially imposed the two-tier wage scale back in 2010, there was a strike vote, and the workers at that time were not willing to take the gamble of going on strike. They did strike in 2015, narrowed the gap between the two tiers, and then they got the new contract just late last year. And you know, that's the collective bargaining picture, but that's kind of a little bit indicative of what happens on an individual level. When you had individual workers who weren't necessarily represented by a union debating, you know, do I settle for whatever the company is offering? Do I maybe accept a pay cut during tough times? Do I say, look, I'm going to demand a pay raise and go elsewhere? You're finally starting to see more quits. That's something the government tracks. How many people are quitting their job, meaning they feel confident enough to go out and either find another job or because they already have another job. The quit rate has gone up, and that's a signal that more people are feeling the freedom to go out there and try the waters a little bit. But that was a long time in coming after the very, very painful recession. Yeah.
Well, let's take a quick call here. Let's go to Pam, who's calling from Williamsburg, Virginia. Pam, you're on the air.
Hi. I worked for the airline. We had a two-tier wage system. The airline never recovered from that. The employees, three unionized groups, pilots, flight attendants, mechanics, they are still suffering under the recession and trying to get back those benefits and pay. Mm. It'll never happen. I'm now with the school system. I'm astonished at how low the pay is, particularly in southern region cities, Newport News, Hampton. The pay is so low, the cost of living has gone up.
Uh-huh.
There is no way to make a living wage. And it seems to me that a culture of poverty is being created. I see it in the school system. And I don't know if anything's ever going to be done to address that.
Right. Well, Pam, thank you so much for your call. Alexia Kulwick, did you want to respond to her?
Sure. I mean, I absolutely agree. I think the way she laid out that dilemma was very articulate. And the thing that I also want to point out is even as we see, so wages have been stagnant across the board, right? If we look at 2017 dollars, wages for manufacturing in Wisconsin have gone up about $1 since, say, 1980. But what's also happened in that time period is workers are paying more for their health insurance. They don't have the defined benefit pension plans that they used to. And so we're so far behind that trying to make those inroads and making those improvements is extraordinarily difficult. And so I agree. I think, you know, coming together and acting collectively poses one potential. Although I think the caller is absolutely right that once you've given something up in that collective bargaining process, it's extremely difficult to regain that and to recapture the benefits that we used to have. So in terms of the culture or the creating an atmosphere of poverty, we certainly have much more inequality in this country than we used to. And it's something that I think both individuals and policymakers needed to pay attention to.
Well, Alexia Kulwick, professor in the School for Workers at the University of Wisconsin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Scott, we were talking about two-tiered wage structures in a lot of workplaces, but another major part of NPR's special series about a full employment economy has to do with the differences in jobless rates that we're seeing amongst Hispanics and African Americans versus white Americans here. And we should say, though, that African American unemployment is also at a historic low right now, even though it's still significantly much higher than for white workers. However, during a speech in Hackberry, Louisiana, just last week, promoting energy infrastructure and economic growth, the president again talked about record low unemployment numbers. And he says it's going to be a campaign signature for him in 2020.
So let's say I'm on the debate stage and we start talking. And I say, well, you know, we have the lowest rate ever for African American, for Asian, for Hispanic. All I have to do is say that and walk off the stage. I guess you win the debate. Who's going to beat you on that? in the history of our country, they're the best unemployment rates.
That's the president in Louisiana last week. Scott, just briefly, how different is the unemployment rate for Hispanic and African Americans versus white Americans?
Well, they've all been coming down, but the African-American unemployment rate is 6.7%. That is still more than twice the rate for white Americans. And so it's a, you know, it's a glass half full or half empty. It's certainly a smaller gap than we've seen in the past, but it's still a pretty high unemployment rate for African-Americans. And there are certainly regional and educational variations that make that rate a lot higher in different areas. I don't think the president is probably going to win a whole lot more support from African Americans in his reelection bid in 2020 than he did in 2016. That argument is probably aimed more at suburban whites to sort of convince them that some of his policies are you know, neutral towards African Americans or whatnot. But he has certainly bragged a lot about falling unemployment rates among both African Americans and Latinos, regardless of what his policies may be. And I'm sure he'll continue to do so right through 2020.
Well, Scott, hang on here for a second, because Andre Perry joins us now, also from Washington. He's a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. His research focuses on race and structural inequality, education and economic inclusion. And he's author of the forthcoming book, Know Your Price: Valuing Black Lives and Property in America's Black Cities. That'll come out in January. Andre Perry, welcome to you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So, you know, this hour we're trying to, vault off of NPR's series here. So take us behind this number of historically low black unemployment. What do you see in that 6.7% that Scott was talking about?
I'll tell you what. If you're black and you're in Baltimore or in Chicago, you don't see full employment. Mm. You see a recession. Historically, the black unemployment rate has always been about twice that of the white rate. And so the rhetoric around full employment really masks what's going on at the city level. We have an inordinate amount of data that show, particularly when you're looking at employers and their callbacks for employees, they do not call back black and potential workers at the same rate at whites. We've known that there's employment discrimination at all levels, those who are highly educated and those who are in need of an education. So the idea of full employment has never incorporated black work rates in a way that would address the structural reasons why they're not absorbed in the economy.
So tell us more about you started talking about some of those structural reasons, but tell us more. Is it as simple, because nothing is simple, but you're talking about callback rates. Is it about who are the employers as well?
Absolutely. I mean, at a very basic level, the unemployment rates reflect who's being hired. So you can't ignore that. But you also cannot ignore a biased criminal justice system that really throttled black men and black women's ability to get the skills to get in the economy. And you also can't discount the wealth gap. Know that how we build businesses or create businesses largely come from our ability to leverage the equity on our homes. And blacks have been denied that. So blacks also have not had the ability to create the jobs themselves in the manner that white people have in the past. So, but at its core, blacks are not hired at the same rates, and they are hired to essentially service white growth. And that's where the rhetoric full employment really hides, that when whites are getting jobs in managerial positions, getting benefits, blacks are working, but they're the Uber and Lyft drivers. They're working in the convenience stores. They're not getting the kind of benefits that will that they can use to build wealth and longevity with their families. And so as long as we keep saying that we're in a state of full employment without recognizing the wage differences, the benefit differences, who's really benefiting from this economy, we're going to just reinforce structural inequality in this country.
Okay, we've got about 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break here, but you said a lot, and I want to dig into a bunch of it. But let me just ask you, though, even given all you said, I mean, as Scott was saying earlier, the rate at which the unemployment rate is falling for African Americans is is pretty significant. That's got to be some good news.
Well, there was another time we were at full employment, blacks were, and it wasn't a good thing. So we got to look at the full picture. And I'm referencing slavery, obviously, but we got to look at the full picture.
All right. Well, we'll take a bigger look at that full picture when we come back. So Andre Perry and Scott Horsley, stand by here for just a second. We're talking about NPR's series all this week about what a full employment economy really looks like in the lives of real people. And we want to hear from you. We'll be right back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about what a full employment economy looks like in the lives of real people. NPR is running a special series all this week about exactly this. And Scott Horsley is with us this hour. He's NPR's chief economics correspondent. Andre Perry is also with us as well. He's a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. And Scott, before the break, you were hearing Andre talk about how the benefits of a full employment economy, he says, haven't at all yet reached the African-American community. What did you find in your reporting?
Well, that's consistent with something Mark Morreale of the Urban League told me years ago, which was, he said, black America is like the caboose on a train. And when the train speeds up, the caboose speeds up, but it's still the caboose. And that's what we've seen. Yes, the unemployment rate among African-Americans has come down from where it was during the recession, just as it has for other groups. But it is still considerably elevated relative to the national average. And, you know, when Andre Perry talks about the wealth gap and not being able to leverage the equity in your home, I mean, the recession was disastrous. Mm-hmm. The subprime mortgage crisis was disastrous for the whole country, but especially for African-American home ownership. And so that's a big scar that is very difficult to recover from. My colleague NPR Daniela Cheslow did a story for our series where she visited Charlotte, North Carolina, which is one of the sort of southern success story cities that have been attracting newcomers. And among African Americans, there's been sort of a reversal of the 20th century great migration from south to north. Now you're seeing African Americans moving from north to south, oftentimes for lower home prices, lower cost of living overall, and in some cases, job opportunities as well. Her story focused on the picture in Charlotte, North Carolina, where there has been an influx of sort of middle-class African-Americans who are finding job opportunities in Charlotte, but that's not necessarily helping the native African-American population. So there's still a core within the city that has very elevated unemployment.
Well, we have a little bit of tape here from exactly this story. This is 32-year-old Brittany Smith. She's African-American, grew up in Detroit. 6 years ago, really struggled to find a full-time job in healthcare in Detroit. And her then-boyfriend and now-husband worked at a college campus that was closing. So they moved to Charlotte.
Here I am, a transplant that has come down here, and I've taken advantage of all these opportunities. Now, some of it may be due to I have, you know, an education, and same for my husband. But also, it made me, actually, my husband and I, to look at ways that we can help, you know, bridge the gap.
That's Brittany Smith, who moved to Charlotte. Andre Perry, is there a reverse great migration going on?
Oh, absolutely, particularly among millennials who are black. Blacks are moving to the South. They're going to Charlotte. They're going to Atlanta. They're going to places where they have a cultural link to. So it's not just about jobs, which it is a major driver. It is also about going home, finding a sense of security, cultural security. And that might seem ironic to some because a lot of people feel that the South is racist, and in many instances it is. But there are communities in the South that blacks have found ways to empower themselves politically, economically. And so, I see it every day, but it's also it's bared out in the numbers.
Mm. Well, you know, we have a lot of callers who want to have their say, so let me welcome them in here. Let's go to George, who's calling from Richmond, Virginia. George, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much. So I just want to give kind of my perspective, kind of boots on the ground. I'm an entrepreneur. I have a technology business, very busy. I have friends in multiple verticals across the city, automobile repair shops, breweries, restaurants, and they're all very busy too. Again, the one thing that we notice is, yes, bargaining is there, but only if it's the right person with the right skills that really has a vision for the company and how to help move the company forward. So I would say that the struggle is, as somebody that hires, is finding the right people, but there's definitely people out there. It's just, we always want to get the right people because we don't want to go through the turnover. Alternatively, segueing off the last comment, Richmond is a Southern city. It's had some issues with race, well known throughout the Civil War. But we too are seeing a movement of African Americans from up north and from the west to Richmond, as well as we're seeing African Americans who come here to go to college not leaving once they graduate and actually participating in and trying to reroute themselves in a place in which their history was rooted. So I think there's a lot from many perspectives. One thing I would like to say is, while it's amazing that Kohler and Wisconsin have such great manufacturing, my family is from Southwest Virginia, Martinsville, and we have a 20% plus unemployment rate. So while it's great in some cities and emerging cities and places that have planned themselves strategically to grow well, there's still places that are very, very hurt by trade agreements that happened 20-some years ago, even before the recession. And how do we get the skills and how do we get the motivation back into those people so that people in the rural areas, rural manufacturing, how do we get them back into the game also?
Well, George, thank you so much for your call. Scott Horsley, let me just turn back to you on that, because this is absolutely a major underlying issue here when you were talking about variations before.
Sure. I mean, Andre Perry's been talking about, for example, in some urban areas, there are pockets where there might be a very high unemployment rate. There are certainly rural communities where that's also the case. One of the highest unemployment rates in the country is the Imperial Valley in California, a rural agricultural area. Likewise, Yuma, Arizona has a very high unemployment rate. So there is absolutely variation. That 3.6 aggregate number for the country masks a whole lot of variation, both positively, as in places like Ames, and negatively in places like Martinsville.
And I have to mention that the last caller mentioned about finding the right people.
Yeah.
You know, and particularly with the tech industry, that typically translates into white men. There is this proliferation of the bro culture you hear about a lot. But we need to work on that, because if we're ever going to solve this problem of having these economic disparities that are consistent over time, we have to have employers trust people who don't look like them and get past this notion of finding the right person, because that is just fraught with this too much error.
Well, Meg, the one thing that we are looking at in our series is how the generally low unemployment rate across the country has created opportunities for people who might have been marginalized in the past. Employers in some cases have grown more creative and are more willing to look past things that would have been disqualifying in the past. For example, people with a disability might have a better chance of finding a work now and an employer who will make some accommodations in order to employ them. And we have a story in our series about former prisoners who are finding job opportunities. That may or may not be the disqualifier that it once was. But of course, the flip side is some employers may just say, it's too hard to find people. I'm going to invest in technology. I'm going to automate this job that I used to have somebody doing. And we see that as well in places where unemployment is very low.
Mm. Well, Andre Perry, though, let me turn back to you on something, because given what we just discussed, and you know, earlier you were talking about how African-Americans, Hispanic-Americans, people of color, genuinely, in your words, you were saying that when the economy expands, they're doing work for white managers. But I wonder, I mean, aren't the very same things that are driving major changes in our economy, the continuing flatlining of union membership, a shift towards gig work in a lot of sectors, these are things that are affecting everyone, and then you could make the argument disproportionately affecting people of color. But given if that's the case, if almost all workers are more vulnerable now than they ever have been before, how do we close the gaps that already exist?
Yeah, if we're going to have to accept this inequality across race and region, because you're absolutely right. Poor white folks in rural communities are struggling, then we're really going to have to talk about a social safety net that really impacts people in urban and rural areas. I'm talking about work guarantees. I'm talking about health care, higher ed. There's going to have to be an expansion of the social safety net if low or high unemployment numbers are a given for particular races and particular regions. Mm.
Well, let's get more callers in here. Let's go to Joanne, who's calling from Tamarack, Florida. Joanne, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I make a decent living. However, I still find it difficult to keep up with the rising cost of living. Mm-hmm. I mean, along with the increased healthcare costs, homeowners insurance, taxes. It's one thing to be employed. I think it's a whole different thing to get a good living wage. And I feel that corporations these days, they're making billions, and it's just not, those profits are just not being passed down to the average working individual. We measure our growth by our savings.
Yeah.
And the average person, we just can't seem to put the threat together to be able to, you know, live comfortably and save.
Right.
And forget putting your kids through college. So what is the solution, and what are the corporations doing to pass down those profits mm-hmm. to the average worker? Because, as I say, you're employed, but your paycheck is small.
Right. Joanne, thank you so much for your call. I mean, Scott, this seems to be right at the heart of the headline of your first story here is America is in full employment, so why aren't we celebrating? I mean, Joanne, I think, echoes the feelings of a lot of Americans about why they're not celebrating.
Right. And, you know, when we talk about inflation, that sort of measures the rise in the price of consistent basket of goods over time. But one of the things your guest Alexia was talking about was, the shifting of some costs from an employer onto workers, whether it's, they're having to shoulder a higher share of their healthcare cost, or maybe the employer's old contribution to their retirement has gone away, or it's shifted from a defined benefit to a defined contribution plan, or maybe there's no retirement plan at all. Tim Taylor, who's the head of the union local in Sheboygan, who represented those Kohler workers who managed to chip away at the two-tiered wage scale successfully last year. He says, you know, this is about bargaining for it. Nobody gives it to you. The owners of corporations are not inclined to share anything with the work, a penny more with the workforce than they need to keep the workforce there. And so it is very much about how the economic pie is divvied up. And for much of this recovery, a lot of the pie was going to the owners of the companies. Mm-hmm. And now we are starting to see workers grabbing a little bit more. But it's you got to grab.
Yeah. Andre,
but you know,
and that's about power. I mean, that's about and whether that's, you know, a low unemployment rate is one way to boost workers' bargaining power. Collective bargaining can be another. A lot of the policy choices can shape that as well.
I'm going to make it plain here that workers are going to have to take back some of that wealth. You will see a rise in labor movements across the country. The strikes, the teacher strikes in recent years or within the last year in red states tell an interesting tale of what's going to happen if those benefits of a quote unquote strong economy aren't passed down to everyday workers. Because yes, we're talking about racial differences and regional differences, but everyone is feeling the pinch of this economy that is not distributing resources equitably.
Well, I mean, to me, it just makes me think, again, as we, you know, we talk about this daily in the news, are we doing a disservice by constantly... I'm not talking about Scott's and NPR series because they're going in depth here. But on, you know, on a daily basis in the news, we just throw out unemployment numbers. And like we're not – what good is understanding that number if we're not also understanding the fundamental insecurities people feel even in this full employment market?
And there's a reason why we bring on economists and people who are in the ivory tower to talk about this stuff, because in a small way, they're protecting – that establishment of distributing information. Yes, we need to talk about wages much more. We need to talk about regional differences. We need to talk about racial differences. We just can't throw out this blunt object of unemployment rate. It really doesn't make much sense when you're going to the ground. And so I'm all for making sure that we project other points of the story, because if we don't, we're really doing the public a disservice.
Yeah, because in NPR series, you hear voices like Charlotte resident Nicole Muse Dennis. She's a single mom raising two daughters on a teacher's salary. Sometimes she works 65 hours a week, having taken a second job as a bar manager at night.
I'm what I call overemployed. I have two jobs, and I'm still just trying to make it and meet the needs that I have for myself and my family.
That's Charlotte resident Nicole Muse Dennis. Scott Horsley, we've got about a minute left here to go. I just want to give you a last shot at telling us a little bit more about what NPR series has in store for us.
Well, as you've hinted at, maybe we are trying to go a little bit behind the headline numbers here and look at a little bit more of the what that means in people's actual lives, what it means for their lifestyles, what the gains, the very real gains for a lot of folks have been, but also some of the persistent fissures that we're still wrestling with.
Well, I'm really glad that this series is happening at NPR, because, again, I do feel strongly that we report average numbers a lot, but there are extreme variances and a lot of real lives that are behind all those average numbers. So Scott Horsley, NPR's chief economics correspondent, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for the series as well, Scott.
Great to be with you.
And Andre Perry, a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and author of the forthcoming book, Know Your Price, Valuing Black Lives and Property in America's Black Cities. Andre Perry, thank you for being with us as well.
Yeah, thank you.
And listeners, you can subscribe, by the way, to the On Point newsletter right on our homepage. Go to onpointradio.org to subscribe. You'll get weekly messages from me and my colleague David Folkenflik, our reading lists, surveys, and a lot more. So check it out. It's our newsletter, and it's at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.